So we're going to call the second and final case of the day, 24-11-018, Frey v. Health Management Systems. Mr. Harris, we wish you were here. It's a lovely day in New Orleans. How are things in Houston?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a nice day here. My apologies to the court and the opposing counsel for not being there in person, but I appreciate the panel accommodating me to participate by phone.
All right. Well, the speaker phone is yours, so take it away.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Alan Harris at Harris Law Firm for appellant relator Christopher Frey. The appellant, Mr. Frey, is a whistleblower, and he filed a quitam suit in district court under the False Claims Act because from his years as an HMS employee, he believed that HMS was wrongfully depriving the government of money by failing to timely submit and properly collect millions of third-party liability claims under the Medicaid programs that HMS handled for the states. We argue today that there were genuine issues and material facts about HMS's failure to bill and pursue CPL claims that should have precluded the district court granting summary judgment to HMS. One of those issues that I would like to draw attention to today is the evidence in the record that shows that HMS wrote off $3.9 billion worth of TPL claims, which included $250 million worth of claims on behalf of the plaintiff states, because they had aged beyond a perceived time period for collection.
Mr. Frey, can I ask you a question? This is Judge Duncan. This is Judge Duncan. I'm the tallest member of the panel. There is an argument that your appeal is untimely. Could you address that, please? Because that goes to our jurisdiction, obviously.
Certainly, Your Honor. We believe our appeal is clearly timely, because the final judgment and order that were dated on October 18th, based on those, we filed our notice of appeal on the Monday following 30 days. 30 days was Sunday, the 17th of November. And so we filed on Monday, the 18th of November, for a timely filing. HMS argues that the filing should have been made based on the October 7th order and judgment, but those were vacated by Judge Boyle. And because they were vacated and they were replaced by the October 17th order and judgment, there was nothing to appeal from based on October 7th. And
I think the argument is what happened is that there was essentially a correction of a clerical error or a typographical error in the opinion, and so that would come under Rule 60A, and so it didn't reset the clock. I think that's the argument. What's your best case that you fall within the 30 days based on this new judgment?
Certainly, the new judgment and order did appear to correct some typos, but there was never a statement by Judge Boyle as to why she was vacating the earlier judgment and orders. And also, her new judgment and orders did not even mention Rule 68. And
okay.
So because of that, we think the reason that she vacated the earlier judgment and order really is not relevant.
Okay, so it's the vacator that is the important point.
The question Judge Duncan asked you, this is Judge Barksdale, the question he asked you was, what's your best case for that?
Right.
The fact that she put the word vacate in her 18 October order.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, Your Honor. Well, there are several cases in the criminal law context where a defendant was determined to have had ineffective representation of counsel, and the courts in those cases vacated their earlier judgments and issued new judgments in order to start a new 30-day time period running and give the defendant another chance. One of those cases was Anderson v. Liberty Lobby in the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986, and actually more precisely, Tampa v. Dillard in the Fifth Circuit in I'm looking at the wrong list of cases. Pardon me. Let me go to
Mr. Harris. Hold on one second. Hold on one second. I want to make sure that opposing counsel can hear everything adequately. Can y'all hear you okay?
Yes, thank
you. Okay, Mr. Harris, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And the cases that I was referring to in the criminal context included United States v. Ruiz Alvarez in the Ninth Circuit. And that was one where a previous order was vacated, replaced by a new order and judgment, and the 30 days ran by the time by the date of that new order and judgment.
Thank you.
So you don't have a civil case?
I do not, Your Honor. There was one case that was cited by HMS. Fetchy case, but that case was on completely different facts. The issue there was the court allegedly mailing notice of their judgment to a wrong address, and so it didn't deal with this sort of issue where the district court is vacating and replacing, if you will, its earlier judgment and order.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. And so the just talking about the evidence in the record about HMS's write-off of $250 million of TPL claims for the plaintiff states. And that evidence shows that there were indeed issues of material fact about the effects of HMS's delay in pursuing claims, as well as the scienter that the HMS executives had and their knowledge of the effects that those actions would have in depriving money that was owed to the plaintiff states and in turn the federal government.
But on the scienter, on the scienter point, what evidence is there that shows HMS subjectively thought it was violating the law?
Well, in those emails that talk about the write-off, there is some discussion about but under the law, HMS still could pursue at least some of these claims for up to 6 years. But then there are replies in the email saying, well, no, we're not going to pursue all of those. We know that. And so it's clear that the HMS executives recognize that they were just letting these claims go. Even as HMS argued, they could have still pursued them. There's also a discussion in the emails about the size of the amounts that are written off and expressions of dismay about that, which I think shows knowledge on the part of HMS of the effects of their failure to continue to pursue these claims would have on the federal government and the state governments, depriving them of money that they should have had collected for them.
The $250 million figure, can you identify a single claim where HMS failed to bill or appeal that produced any actual loss to the states?
Those 250 million claims, they all do appear to have been billed because they were in what was called open status with carriers, where HMS was supposedly working with the carriers to work them. But then HMS just let them go. And so that's those are examples of claims that, yes, they were billed, but HMS did not continue the follow-through on processing and collecting those claims as it should have been. I can't point to a particular claim by name or dollar amount where there was a failure to appeal that resulted in a loss of that claim, but there was deposition testimony cited in our briefs that HMS did fail to pursue those claims, a number of those appeals, or just simply refiled what they'd filed before when they had been rejected. Deposition testimony by David Hancock and by Elena Morsenko, for example.
Well, I'm curious what the law requires or what the regulations require HMS to do with denied appeals. Is there any kind of statutory support for the proposition that state Medicaid agencies must appeal all denied claims, even so-called low-dollar claims?
There is certainly contractual support for that requirement because the HMS's contracts with the states did require them to pursue appeals. And I think that even though there may not be something specific in the regulations and the Medicaid regulations that say you must also appeal claims that you are pursuing, I think it's a natural result of their obligation to pursue claims, and it certainly was part of their contracts with the states.
Okay. Anything else?
The one thing that the district court's opinion said that I think is particularly inaccurate is that at worst HMS was just tardy in billing and collecting claims. But the facts show that it is much different than just being tardy in collecting claims. That HMS's delays and failure to follow through on claims actually did result in claims being written off and lost to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. There's also discussion in the opinion, the district court opinion, about about the Sienta. We've touched on that to some degree, but I just wanted to reemphasize that these emails, in particular, that I've mentioned, show that HMS executives were well aware that they were falling short in their obligation to pursue these claims, that they could have continued pursuing them after 3 years, but that they knew that that was going to cost the government money when they did not pursue them.
Okay.
And with that, unless the panel has any other questions, I will rest my argument until rebuttal.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We'll now hear argument from Health Management Systems. Ms. Ho, step right up.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This is one in a long line of lawsuits brought by Mr. Fry against his former employer, HMS, and like the others, it's built on nothing but unsupported factual assertions and erroneous legal conclusions. This court doesn't need to sift through Mr. Fry's insubstantial merits arguments.
Well, let's start with the question of whether or not the appeal was timely. Frankly, the case you cite in support of this not being timely, which I happened to be on the panel in 1993 with Judges Dewey and Jolly, does not support your position at all. And the word vacate appears in this order, and that's a big word to get around. What is your understanding of an order being vacated?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think what it means for an order to be vacated is the order is simply rendered, it is sort of taken off. And in this case, I think what matters, Judge Barksdale, is that the order was replaced by a substantively identical order that made corrections under 60A.
But Judge Boyle selected the word vacate.
And, Your Honor, I think, and this is where I think the case, respectfully, that you, as you say, you were on the panel, but I think Crossland versus Fenty, which was the case that my friend on the other side was talking about, actually is the name.
Your friend on the other side is in Houston.
Yes, who referenced the Fenty case, and it's the Crossland versus Fenty. And in that case, this court considered exactly the situation you have here. It envisioned a situation where, in fact, the request in that case was for the district court to vacate and amend its order and re-enter it, because the movements in that case were trying to reset an appellate clock that had run. And this court said, no, even if the district court in that case had granted your motion under Rule 60A and had vacated and amended the judgment, it wouldn't matter for your appellate clock purposes, because changes made under Rule 60A don't restart the clock. And so I think in Crossland versus Fenty, this court dealt with exactly the situation you have here, where the district court in that case had been asked to vacate and amend.
So just as a practical matter, we're going to require lawyers, when they see that an order has been vacated, to run check and make sure that it touched all the bases for Rule 60A or whatever else, and know they've got to timely appeal. I just think that puts a terrific burden on lawyers, that they can't accept at face value what a judge says in an order, which is, this is vacated. It's null and void. It's wiped out. And I don't think that's the burden we need to put on anyone.
Respectfully, Your Honor,
especially when the order itself doesn't even point out the corrections that are being made. You had to go through in there and read it word by word. And I don't know how long that would have taken, not long at all, but that's just seems very, very Alice in Wonderland, that we can't take a judge, when a judge says, this is vacated, we can't take the judge's word for it. Maybe she had a reason for that. We don't know. All we can judge a judge by is the words on the paper, and she vacated.
Well, I would go back to this court's decision in Crossland versus Fenty, which was exactly the same situation that this court envisioned, which was a vacator and a reentry of judgment. And it said it wouldn't matter if the court vacated and reentered. There is no requirement in Rule 60A about making the key, Your Honor, is looking at substance, not form. Did the changes made affect the substantial rights in any way? And my friend on the other side makes no argument that this is anything but a Rule 60A correction, and for good reason. And this court, in another decision, in Chavez versus Baelish, there the court did reference Rule 60, but it wasn't clear whether it was Rule 60A or Rule 60B. And this court went through a process of analysis, looked at the order and said, well, it can't possibly be under 60B because there was no motion filed or no notice, and that's a requirement. So it can only be under 60A, which does not have sort of a formalistic requirement. But even Your Honor, if we agree to disagree on jurisdiction, if Your Honors don't dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction, we do believe you should affirm the judgment below on the merits for at least two alternative independent reasons. The first reason is that none of Frye's theories raise any material fact issue on this well-developed record, which is devoid of any evidence that any non-recovery of a third-party liability claim shorted the government one penny. And I believe
Frye points to these internal emails that acknowledge missed CMS deadlines. And why wouldn't that create a triable issue on knowing avoidance?
Sure. Your Honor, I think if anything, the $250 million closeout email refutes Mr. Frye's own theories, and undisputed evidence establishes that all of those claims, and I heard my friend concede this as he must today, all of those claims were marked open, which means that HMS already submitted them, right? So these are all claims that have already been submitted to the carriers. Beyond that, the email itself says, we can still follow up on all claims that were closed. That's ROA 4043. We can work any population of claims with recovery potential. That's ROA 4043. And can pursue them for an additional six-year period. So the reason that my friend on the other side cannot give you one claim that either was not submitted or not timely submitted is because as a matter of law, HMS had 3 years to submit the claims, and in the email, all of these claims have already submitted. And then on top of that, HMS had another 6 years to follow up on those claims. So the universe of claims that we're talking about in this email, none of them fall into any theory that Mr. Frye offers. And even if you thought that the HMS was wrong on the law on this score, the email itself is evidence that there is simply no evidence of the knowing element here. And I think that is throughout this record, and that is an independent alternative ground for affirmance here. There is simply no evidence of that essential knowledge estimate. And to the contrary, HMS employees repeatedly testified without contradiction that they subjectively believed that HMS had 3 years to submit a claim. That's ROA 2657, 2708, 2715, 2766, and 2785. And that is also consistent with CMS guidance materials provided to HMS, known as the CMS, the government agency that administered the program. And that's at ROA 3132 through 33. So even if there is jurisdiction, even if Judge Boyle got it wrong on the law with respect to the 3 years and the 6 years, on this record, I think there can be no real argument that there is any evidence whatsoever of the requisite knowledge element, which in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in Super Value, we know is a subjective test. If there are no further questions, I'm happy to answer for the questions or give the court's time.
Okay, Ms. Ho, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Harris, you're still with us. If so, you've got 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. First of all, on the issue of the timeliness of the filing of the notice of appeal, I think that's an astute observation that the judge used the word vacate, and for whatever reason that she did so vacate the previous judgment and order, she doesn't mention the reasons why or even mention 60A. As for the emails about the write-offs establishing a material fact issue, I think they do create lots of issues of material fact. They show, certainly, that there was this large write-off of claims that HMS ceased pursuing. It shows that executives knew that these claims would be would result in no money coming to the government. It shows that they were not going to pursue all these claims any further. And so those are all issues of triable fact for a jury in the district court to determine. Based on these issues of fact, did or did not HMS fail to collect these hundreds of millions of dollars worth of claims to the detriment of the federal government? My colleague or opposing counsel, Ms. Ho, mentions that HMS actually had a 6-year period to total to continue trying to collect these claims after that 3-year cliff. But the record itself says Wilma Etheridge, regional vice president, I do not believe we want to follow up on everything outstanding for 6 years. That's ROA 4050. And also in those emails, it's explained that these claims were flagged as having gone past the 3-year period allowed by the Deficit Reduction Act, and they were deemed no longer workable. That's ROA 4038. My opposing counsel also mentions the subjective belief of HMS personnel that they had 3 years to submit claims, and the district court's opinion mentions that as well. But that subjective belief is undercut by the fact that these $250 million worth of claims were written off, and HMS executives knew that. And whether they believed at the time when they first filed the claim, whether they had 3 years or not, the 3-year period ended without all these claims being collected. And so those claims dropped off the cliff, and HMS wrote them off. And so regardless of that subjective belief, the real fact is that HMS cost the plaintiff state governments and the federal government $250 million.
Okay. Anything else?
Unless the court has any other questions, I do not have anything else, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Harris, thank you. Ms. Ho, thank you.
May I make a comment? Mr. Harris, I hope you understand the gravity of what you have done today by not being in court. And because of the grace of this panel, we're allowing you to participate in this very unsatisfactory methodology. And it is a very, very serious matter that you weren't here today. And I want you to understand that. And we certainly would be entitled to impose sanctions on you. But you're fortunate. But don't ever let this happen again.
Yes, Your Honor. It certainly is a lesson learned, and I do take this very seriously. When I realized this morning that I had had the date wrong, my heart dropped into my stomach. And so I appreciate you and the panel being so accommodating to allow me to participate. And I certainly will not let something like this happen again.
How many years have you practiced law?
I've been practicing law for 35 years, although for most of that career, it was a transactional practice rather than a litigation practice.
Mr. Harris, thank you. Ms. Ho, thank you. The court will stand in recess until 10:30 tomorrow morning.